Episode 210, recorded June 9th, 2014.
Welcome, Aquarimaxers, one and all, new and old. Things like that.
Something borrowed, and we have borrowed listeners and blue listeners?
I don't know. I hope we don't have any blue listeners.
Yeah.
That would be sad.
That would be a little uncomfortable.
No, I just mean blue, like sad blue, you know.
Oh, I was thinking like blue in the face because they were choking.
Well, because they're running out of air, that's true.
Yeah, that would be bad too. We hope you're not, none of you are blue in any way, shape, or form.
So who are...
Unless you're an alien, then it's okay.
Who are our contributors today? That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Carlos in New York. Jeremiah in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Derek, who is from England but is living in Limoges, France. Tom in Provo. Sean in Asheville, North Carolina. And Dr. Bob on the North Shore of Boston.
Cool. So who's first?
Carlos is first.
What does he have to say?
He says that he bought some Australebius nigripinus.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little bit difficult for me. Okay. But that's what he bought.
Yep.
At the AKA convention.
American Killifish Association.
Oh, okay. There we go. This past weekend, and I was wondering what you can tell me about peat spawners and how to dry the peat and hatch the eggs after the incubation period. Thanks.
Okay, well, you know, I've never actually kept peat spawning killifish before. I wish I could tell you more. I've read on how to do it, but I don't really feel qualified to just tell you because I've read it, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, why don't we just, I'm going to send the word out. I did this on Facebook already, but I'll do it on the show. If you have kept peat spawning killifish and you have successfully bred them, why don't you send us an email or a message, you know, or call us up and we'll set up an interview or something? Because I would love to have one on that. I've wanted to spawn peat spawning killifish for a long time, and I've read a lot about it. And I have bred vernal pool crustaceans of various sorts that have a life cycle that's strikingly similar to peat spawning killifish. So some of the particulars I can relate to, but I just don't feel like I can tell anybody, yeah, this is how you do it, when I've never done it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, if you've never done it, maybe we should just get some sometime.
Well, I would like to do that too. But we would like to help Carlos out, but we need your expertise, Aquarimaxers. You killifish people, you. Mm. Those of you who are killifish people. Peat spawning killifish. You know, there are lots of different...
You peat spawning killifish?
They're also known as, you know, substrate spawning killifish. As opposed to the kind that Tony keeps, which just spawn in the plants and then, you know, they just hatch. They don't need a drying period. They don't need a diapause.
Hmm.
But, you know, it would be interesting to see. And there are some that are kind of facultative. They can do either one. Either diapause or not. But, yeah. So I don't even think... I was thinking, you know, I could give you a few basics on the things that I've read, but I just don't feel like I should because I want someone else to do it. Who knows more? Because they've done it firsthand.
Okay.
You know?
So, Carlos will have to wait for an answer.
So we're counting on you, Aquarimaxers, to provide Carlos with a good... first-hand experience sort of answer.
And in the meantime, we'll go on to Jeremiah in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Mm-hmm. He had sent us a message earlier saying two things. What kind of plants would you recommend for my small tank of shrimp? And what kind of shrimp do you think I have, I think?
He sent us a picture?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. What kind of shrimp did we think he had?
Well, we'll get to that. It's in there.
Okay. He says, I listened to the latest episode, and I first wanted to say thank you for suggesting various Anubia species. I'll be looking to incorporate that into the tank next paycheck, along with some lava rock to keep the Anubias weighted down.
Excellent choice.
Mm-hmm. Russ's guess on my use of CO2, or rather lack thereof, was accurate. I prefer low-tech tanks, easier on the budget. I was wondering, though, why CO2 in a sponge filter would be a bad idea. I haven't researched high-tech, so please excuse my ignorance.
Okay, well, that's a good question. Essentially, a sponge filter works with an airlift, right? Most sponge mm-hmm. filters work that way. There are some others, too, but I'm envisioning the one he has is powered by an air pump that draws water through a tube that draws a slow current of water through the sponge and then up through the air tube. And that's how it functions. Okay. When you're doing that, you're having air bubbles reach the surface and disturb the surface of the water, which mm-hmm. tends to drive off CO2. When you use...
So it pushes it out of the water back up into the air.
Yes. It reduces this concentration of CO2, so it's rather pointless to inject CO2 if you're going to do that.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Did I explain myself clearly?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. That's why when you do see a CO2 injection, you keep turbulence of the water surface to a minimum. Otherwise, the CO2 just diffuses back into the atmosphere because of all that surface area it can escape from.
Surface area.
So that's why.
Okay.
And hopefully that answers the question there.
Okay, he goes on to say, as to this species of shrimp, unfortunately, one of my shrimp passed away recently. I, however, took the opportunity to snap a photo of the specimen, which realistically is the only way I'd be able to get a picture, as I'm unfortunately a poor photographer, and whatever species of shrimp I have are rather shy and quick. Please see the attached link.
Which I did, and it appears to be, indeed, probably, a wild cherry shrimp, or wild color of the type known as red cherry shrimp. Very familiar, kind of, that I've kept for years, so I expect that's what it is. I'm not an expert at identifying the particular species.
I like identifying.
Sorry about that.
Well, that's a good one. Can we keep it?
I think that's what you've got.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, sorry you lost one.
Yeah. But at least it led to, you know,
scientific probable identification. Progress?
Yeah,
actual advances in the fields of science. Well, you know what Calvin Hobbes says.
What?
Scientific progress goes boink. Yes. Well,
thank you, Jeremiah, and hopefully that is helpful.
Okay, Derek in France. He says, I recently discovered your show. I'm an Englishman living in Limoges, France, and although I don't have any fish at the moment, I'm very interested in inverts and trying to breed assassin snails, maybe to sell. I'm very excited because I have about 15 eggs waiting to hatch. Good luck with your fishy stuff.
And look at that. He made it some little snails.
Get
little
it.
ASCII character snails. It's cool.
That's really cute.
I've never seen those before.
I was wondering what that was, and now I get it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool.
That's very cute.
Okay. So, well, welcome, Derek, to the world of Aquarimax, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
Glad to have you on board as a contributor and listener. And good luck with your assassin snails. They're a lot of fun. I like assassin snails. The something I could say about the eggs, the hatch rate is not great, not stellar, but with 15 eggs, I'm sure you'll get some. They're slow. Much slower than other snails.
They take longer
but
to grow.
They take longer to grow up, and you usually don't see them until they're quite a bit bigger than you might expect, like a quarter of an inch or a third of an inch or so. Pretty big before you usually notice them. But with 15, I'm sure you'll get a lot soon, and that they'll be laying more because they lay eggs like crazy. And the fact that you don't have fish in the tank is actually a point in your favor for breeding assassin snails because...
So the fish don't eat them.
Well, it's not so much that they eat the assassin snails unless they're really snailivorous.
Well...
But...
Okay, wait. So now we've got snailivorous and identificate. How did you say it?
I said snailivorous.
You did. I like it.
You do?
I like the other one too, but I can't... I know, but I can't remember what the other one was now. Identifying...
Identifying, there you go.
Yes, okay. We
Maybe
have
I should say gastropodivorous.
Oh, that's pretty good,
or
too.
Molluscivorous? I don't know.
I like
gastropodivorous. Anyway.
That should be a t-shirt.
Yeah. So if you have fish in the tank and you want to feed them, say, like chopped mussels or mysis shrimp or something like that as a nice meaty food that's good for the assassin snails, because the fish will eat them. They'll beat the snails to the punch and they won't have any left. But if you just have assassin snails in there, they can just eat it at their leisure. Of course, if you're feeding snails, it's not that big of a deal.
Mm.
And snails are a good food
you
for
mean
them, obviously.
Feeding snails
to
the
snails.
Assassin snails.
Right. Then
using snails for food.
If you drop snails in there with the shells on, and most, well, there are fish that will eat them, and in general, fish don't bug the snails as much as they would go for, like, chopped mussels or mysis shrimp, so that's
right.
All I'm saying.
Okay.
So, I really do hope they breed for you well. They're fun snails to have, and really, really useful in a tank that is plagued by other snails.
And can we really do that? We need to put it on our t-shirt list.
Do what?
We can have like a little cartoon of an assassin snails with like this mouth full of jagged...
Radulae.
Scary teeth looking, like a cartoon one. And it can say gastro...
I'm a gastropodivorous.
Yeah.
Do you want to be gastropodivorous too?
That would be awesome. Come on. Should put me in charge of t-shirts.
Yeah.
Nobody would buy them.
Oh, yes, they
would. Okay. So, Tom in Provo. He says, I've been thinking lately about what I feed my fish. They are harlequin rasboras, neon tetras, and a few live bearers. I'm planning to rehome the live bearers and get a few other small fish, such as ember tetras or chili rasboras. Boraras.
I say Boraras.
Boraras.
Mm-hmm.
Brigate.
Okay.
I love that. How you just said okay meant that was totally wrong.
No, that's not what I meant. I just meant, okay, we can proceed to the next sentence now. Because I just butchered the name. No.
Okay. To date, the fish have been given almost exclusively dry food containing color enhancers and good quality ingredients. They seem to be doing well, they are active and have good color, but I wonder if they need more variety. So, two questions. One, if I decided to provide them occasional live food, what would be a good choice, keeping in mind that I am much too lazy to culture two different foods? I am not expecting anything to spawn, so there should be no fried feed.
Okay.
Do you want me to read the second question first?
Let's do this one first. Okay. Well, if you want to offer live food, and you're only going to keep you're only going to keep a small fish, like the chili rasboras, ember tetras, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You have some neon tetras, halicon rasboras. I would say one good choice would be nematodes, like Walter worms or microworms. They're very easy to culture and harvest. They don't take up a lot of space. You can enrich them easily with color enhancers and so on. And small fish eat them readily.
They dig them.
They really do.
They're like small fish potato chips. And you can't eat just one.
In my experience, things that are the size of neon tetras or smaller, and some fish that are even larger. I don't know if the harlequin reservoirs would go for them as much, but they probably would. But the chili reservoirs would definitely go for them, and so would the neon tetras and the ember tetras. They're so easy, so cheap, really, really good choice, I think. So, yeah, that would be one to go with. If you want something that's a little bit more effort, maybe grindle worms. Since you don't have that many fish, I really wouldn't do fruit flies. And, because they produce so many of them, you have to get rid of them. You have to do something with them.
And you have to always reculture it. Like, yeah. Every 5 minutes.
No, it's about every month.
See?
But you have to reculture the Walter worms less. The fruit flies are really easy, but they just, there's a lot of them, and you have to deal with them somehow.
You have to have enough to feed them.
If you don't know what to do with them, I mean, you got to throw some in the freezer or something. So,
then you have bugs in your freezer.
So, I would say try the nematodes. If you don't want to do wormy kind of things, if you want to do crustaceans, amphipods are as easy as falling off a log. They are like the easiest thing in the world. And
they just grow in the tank.
They will if you don't have fish that will eat them fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really easy. Daphnia are not quite as easy, but they're still fairly easy, and you can do it in like a 1/2 gallon to a gallon jar if you don't want to do them that often. And then every week you pour off 1/2 the water through a brine shrimp net, and then just swish that brine shrimp net in your tank, feeding off whatever landed in there. And then you put, you know, new water in the container. And then there you go. That's all the maintenance you have to do, and then you just harvest and feed. Well, I guess harvesting and feeding are maintenance too in a way. Not harvesting, because you already did that. But feeding, you'd feed, a couple of drops of food every other day or so. It'd be really easy, too. So those are some ideas.
Okay. The second question is, if it turns out that I am too lazy to culture even one food, what would be a good choice of frozen food, or will the fish be fine the way they are?
Let me answer the second of those two questions first.
Okay.
You're not going to spawn them, you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
So they will be fine the way they are. You're giving them good quality food. You're giving them color enhancers. They look healthy. They'll stay healthy if you're giving them what you're giving them. As long as you keep, you make sure the food doesn't expire and you keep it dry and keep it from the oxygen out of it, and stuff. And you replace it when you need to. And I know you're already feeding good quality food. They will be fine. They will live a long, happy life without ever touching live food. But if you want to add some frozen food, I like mysis shrimp, frozen copepods. Those are some good ones for your situation with the small fish like that. I would say if you're going to do frozen food, make sure that you use a store you can trust that doesn't let the food thaw and then freeze again, because then it gets worthless and yucky and it's completely pointless, a waste of money. And when you do buy it, bring a small cooler along with you, full of ice, and toss it in there, unless like the store is a block away and you just go there on your way home, because it really melts fast. And so whenever I get it, I bring along like a lunch cooler with some ice in it. And that just helps. Make sure it doesn't freeze and then thaw
again. Keep it all the way frozen.
Yeah, because otherwise it will start to thaw generally. So there's some things. But the fish really will be fine the way they are because you're not spawning them. I mean, one of the main reasons for live food is to bring fish into spawning condition, and you're not concerned about that right now, so you don't have to worry about that. One of the other main reasons is that larval fish, when they just hatch and they become free swimming and start to eat, often don't recognize non-living food, and even if they do, they won't often thrive unless they get some for a little while. So those are like the two main reasons for live food, and you don't have to be concerned about those. So, just saying, if you want to keep it simple, you can. Kind of nice.
Alrighty. So, Sean in Asheville, North Carolina. Thank you, Tom. He says, "Hey there, still loving your show. Life has been in the way as usual, but you've been my lifeline, keeping me moving along the Aquaria front."
Moving along the Aquaria front. Hey, that's good for a t-shirt.
That's good.
Aquaramax. And then we have a picture.
And you can have a picture of the word Aquaramax all dressed up like a tugboat pulling a big fish tank.
Oh, okay.
Or not.
No, that'll work. That's kind of fun.
I get weird ideas. But, you know, nobody else will have the same t-shirt.
It's very true.
Okay. He says, "I don't know if you recall, but I'm still having the issue of the quarries clouding the water."
We talked about that in our live hangout, didn't we?
"I've decided I'm going to redo the 70-gallon, the one with the quarries. Before I do that, though, I'm going to do a substrate experiment in a 3x10-gallon aquarium."
No, he means three 10-gallon aquariums. Like, when he's saying aquarium, he means
okay.
three.
Okay, I was trying to figure out what that meant, because I couldn't picture a 10-gallon aquarium that was only, like, 3 inches wide.
Right, he means three times 10-gallon aquarium.
That makes so much more sense. Thank you. Okay. "The goal is to find if there's a safe depth of sand that will mostly keep the bottom dwellers from getting to the soil underneath. I'll have a control tank with all sand substrate and two others with different depths of sand to be decided over the soil. I'll plant them and cycle with household NH4.
Ammonia.
Okay. The transplant some of my dozens of quarries into each to see how they do with the substrates."
Very cool.
Yeah, you take lots of records and share them with us. "After I determine which way to go, I should document and publish the experiment on the web."
Yeah, see, same idea.
See,
yeah,
I'm so
idea.
Good. "My plan will be to pull the fish and plants, except stem plants, which I'll dispose of. They grow way too fast. And put them in a clean, large trash bin until the 70 is available again." He's keeping the fish in
the...
You're
going to put the plants and the fish in the bin. The trash bin. To
keep
them.
With water.
Yes, with water.
Okay. And he probably means like an actual garbage bin with a liner in it.
Well, he means...
Not a liner?
Probably
I'm
just a plastic
bag. I'm picturing
bin.
Just the plastic bag going, that doesn't sound like it's
going to... No, he means the bin.
Okay.
The bin.
Okay.
He says the bin, see? Trash
he
bin.
Does say the bin. Yeah. It just popped into my head as just the bag.
Oh, okay.
Made me pause.
Okay.
"Thinking of trying to save the sand and wash away the soil with minimal rinsing of the actual aquarium in the hopes of retaining as much nitrifying bacteria as possible. Any thoughts on how much recycling might need to happen? I'll replant the tank and cycle with household ammonia again, hoping a couple of weeks or less. Anywho, you guys have great stamina doing the show every week. Keep it up. Thanks."
Thank you.
Except
sorry.
For last week.
Sorry last week. We kind of missed
week.
It. But
yeah.
We do appreciate...
Russ was really sick.
And everything.
But now he's better.
I am doing better. Yes. So, I think it's a great idea, what you're doing. Documenting and publishing results would be great.
Mm-hmm.
If I could, I would just have a huge lab where I could do stuff like that.
I know, you'd be so
time.
Happy.
It would be awesome.
Somebody needs to just pay you to be a fish think tank. See, we could call it think tank. See, that's good, right?
I like that. That's good. That is good. So, well, my thought about the recycling is that protecting the actual glass from rinsing might provide a minimal benefit in terms of cycling, but not a great one. Because the glass just doesn't have... I mean, it does have surface area. And if you look at it under a microscope, you know, it's got texture. It's got some surface. And there will be bacteria there, I'm sure. But this is what I'm thinking. The plants in that bin, as long as they're getting plenty of oxygen and everything, are going to be a much greater repository of beneficial bacteria. Their surfaces. That's
plus
they're
plants, so they pull out goo.
Right. And also, if they are growing healthily and quickly, they could be sequestering ammonium so fast the bacteria wouldn't even get a crack at it yet. So if you get enough plants in there right as you plant it, you might not even worry about cycling. in terms of, you could just, well, if you want to be very careful, which is probably a good idea, you could just plant it, not put the corys in yet, and just put some ammonia in, and then see, you know, start testing for ammonia and see how fast it gets pulled out. You might not even have to cycle it because the plants might be just getting rid of it. I mean, it's not going to be as pronounced an effect if you don't have stem plants in there, because they grow so fast, they pull it out like anything. They're nutrient sponges, but you see what I'm saying? It might be something to think about.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of particular time it might take, it varies. There's so many things that vary that it's going to be hard to predict how long it'll take. Mm-hmm. But I just think the plants will be doing more than the actual glass. By a long shot, that's my
I think that makes
take
sense.
On it.
Okay.
And it's a great idea. We want to hear about it. We want to see it.
Yep. Keep us posted. Should we go to Dr. Bob?
Yes.
Okay. He says, "You may recall I asked some time ago about ponds because I was considering one. Well, it didn't happen because the boss said I had to paint the house before I could consider another aqua project. So together we built a mini water garden for the deck." That's cool, too.
Mm-hmm.
"I'm viewing this as an experiment, and this is what I have found. The location on the deck receives a good 6 to 8 hours of direct sun during the month before and after the summer solstice. Then the area slowly reduces to about 4 to 6 hours as we move toward the autumnal equinox. The planter is about 10 gallons filled to about 2 inches from the rim. It is currently planted with water lettuce, water hyacinth, and acala." Acala? Acala lily.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. "The plants cover nearly the entire surface of the water. I installed a small circulator pump with a foam filter on the intake a couple of inches below the surface, which produces a little 2-plus-inch fountain of water. I also have a remote thermometer to monitor the water temperature. My observation has been that the water temperature comes close to matching the air temperature at the extremes of high and low during a given day. Overcast will slow the rise in temperature. Now, I know that I have heard you and other aquamaxers talking about keeping fish and Daphne in buckets and tubs outdoors during the summer. How do you keep from cooking your fish, especially in 100-plus Arizona heat?"
Yeah. Well, we do have to contend with 100-plus temperatures here almost every summer. It's probably not as bad as it is in Arizona, but it gets really hot, and it does get over 100, and we will have like a week and a half where it doesn't go below that during the... I mean, mm-hmm. we don't have a high that's below that during the day. At night, it certainly cools off. But anyway, yeah, great question. One thing that he goes into a little later, he says that, "I imagine that since my pond will be in the ground and have a few more gallons of water in it, it would be better buffered, but I do recall years ago, our 7,000-gallon pool would get into the upper 90s on especially hot weeks." And it's true. Being in the ground and being a larger body of water, you're going to get less of a temperature fluctuation, but you will still get one. If a lot of sun's hitting it, it won't be nearly as pronounced, because it sounds like if you have a 10-gallon capacity little water garden and you'll have it filled 2 inches from the top, it might have like 8 gallons of water in it. And that's not a lot in terms of, not a lot of thermal latency, really. So you're going to get temperature fluctuations. It also depends, I mean, that's a lot of sun too. Not that you can't do ponds with a lot of sun, you can. The larger the pond, the deeper the pond, you know, the better it handles it. But the Daphnia buckets that I've talked about on the podcast only got maybe 1 to 2 hours of morning sun. They were on the east side of the house. They were under the roof awning thing, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so they only got maybe 1 to 2 hours of direct sun at the most, and it was always early in the morning. A function of where the mountains are and where the trees are and, you know, all this stuff. It worked out that way. They did not get very much direct sun. They got bright light much of the day, but they didn't get direct sun for more than 1 or 2. And that really helped keep him cool. And it seems to me that even when the air temperature was in the hundreds or so, the water temperature was still in the 80s.
Because it was in the shade.
Because of that. Partly because of that. It was in the shade. It was aerated.
Mm-hmm.
That helped. And so on. So I think that was kind of our secret. And the bigger the pond and the more the water flow and those sorts of things will help too. But yeah, that is a challenge. I can see why that would be an issue. How would you keep... you know, some fish actually do amazingly well. If they're in an outdoor pond, they seem to be able to handle temperature fluctuations. better than they would if they were indoors, and I'm not sure why that is. If it's something about the gradual nature of the temperature change or the cyclical nature of it or whatever, but I've heard people, and I haven't done this, but people who have spawned bettas outside and kept them in temperature extremes that we would never dream of keeping them in indoors, and they seem to do fine. Part of it is, too, that, you know, the top couple of inches of the water temperature are going to be warmer than the lower reaches of the aquarium in most cases, even a smaller bucket or tub, that's often the case. It also depends on how fast the water flow is and things like that, but that's something to think about. So hopefully that helps.
I don't know, can you think about it? He says, later on, he says, I know that there are desert killifish species, like the devil's hole pupfish, that can handle water temperatures above 100 degrees, but they wouldn't be a good choice for New England with periodic sub-zero winter temperatures. And I don't know of the availability of those species. Any suggestions or tips would be helpful. So is there anything that would be happy?
Well, I'm thinking fish. I wouldn't necessarily look into the devil's hole pupfish. I don't. I mean, you could check.
Well, and he was saying it wouldn't be good in the winter.
Yeah, it definitely wouldn't be good in the winter. But I'm thinking that it might be more about ways to change the microclimate in the little water garden.
Rather than try to find a fish.
Yeah.
That probably would be more successful.
I mean, I know water gardens were really popular in Hawaii, and they would be really low-tech ones, like they just have a planter with plants growing in it, and they'd have fish, and they'd put it in it, and they wouldn't think about it. You know, it'd just be fine, and it would eat mosquito larvae and stuff. And but the one thing about it is that it doesn't usually get to 100 degrees there. It got into the 90s while we lived there. Mm. Sometimes in the summer, that was really fairly humid. Common. And it was really humid, but it doesn't get into, it's not like 105 ever there. Not where we were anyway. So, one thing, how much sun does the planter on the outside of the planter get? Because I think that's going to be a big thing.
Versus just the top of the water.
Right. If you had some way to shade the front of the planter, if it's the side of the planter that's getting hit by the sun, I don't really know. But that could really reduce temperatures.
That would be good.
Be something to think about. So maybe you can send us a picture of it.
That's a good idea.
Well, that might be an idea. So, yeah, I think that's about it, ladies and gentlemen, for this week.
Good, everybody?
Isn't it? Yeah, I think so. Hopefully we helped you all out, and hopefully you have a lovely fishy week.
So may the fish
be with you.